of what's happening at the UN summit, as we have for every UN climate summit since Copenhagen in 2009, featuring voices inside the COP, climate activists protesting outside, and advocates from the global south who couldn't travel to Scotland during the pandemic. More than 100,000 people are expected to be in the streets of Glasgow on Saturday. We'll air highlights on Monday. You can visit us at democracynow.org to see all of our coverage this week. And that does it for our show. Happy birthday to John Hamilton. Democracy Now! Has job openings at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be when the war is won, we will be.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an unethical public autopsy shocks Portlanders, Medford teachers sue over a discriminatory law, and in international news, critics warn that the COP26 climate conference doesn't go far enough. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 5th, 2021. I'm Sam Bowman. The Newburgh School Board narrowly passed a controversial measure in September forbidding Black Lives Matter and pride symbols in public schools. Now Newburgh educators are suing in protest. According to a lawsuit filed by the Newburgh Education Association, the so-called Ensuring Safe Environments to Learn policy violates both the U.S. and Oregon constitutions by prohibiting free speech and creating ambiguous and discriminatory prohibitions. If the lawsuit reaches the Yamhill County Circuit Court, it could block the measure from going into effect. Newburgh Public Schools have been in the public eye not just for the controversial vote, but also because of several racist incidents in the past year. One elementary school assistant came to school in blackface on September 17th, allegedly in protest of vaccine mandates. White Newburgh High School students also participated in a Snapchat group called Slave Trade, where they held a mock auction of black classmates. Elsie Saunders, a 92-year-old Louisiana woman, was horrified to discover that her husband's body was dissected in front of a paying audience at a Portland Marriott hotel last month. Her 98-year-old husband, David Saunders, had his body donated to a Vegas-based medical company, MedEd Labs, after dying of COVID. Elsie Saunders had been told his body would be used for research. Instead, MedEd Labs sold his body to Death Science, a YouTube and TikTok-based media company run by a man named Jeremy Siliberto, who is not a trained medical expert. Death Science publicly dissected David at their Oddities and Curiosities Expo, an event advertised for lovers of the strange, unusual, and bizarre in Portland. Multnomah County Medical Examiner Kimberly DeLeo convinced Marriott staff to cancel the dissection at their city center location. The hotel complied, instead moving the event to their waterfront location. The autopsy was conducted by former anatomy professor Colin Henderson. Henderson was neither licensed to practice medicine nor wearing adequate safety supplies while handling the corpse. Onlookers were not informed that the subject had died from COVID. The Portland police denied to press criminal charges. A spokesman stated that they had determined no crimes had been committed. Nevertheless, Elsie Saunders may still pursue a civil suit against Marriott, Death Science, MedEd Labs, or any of the other parties involved. Elsie Saunders told one Baton Rouge paper, quote, "As far as I'm concerned, it's horrible, unethical, and I don't have words to describe it. I have all this paperwork saying his body would be used for science, nothing about the commercialization of his death," end quote. Today is Bank Transfer Day. 10 years ago, 40,000 people began a movement to transfer their money to nonprofit credit unions. The vice president of one Portland credit union reflects on those changes a decade on. With more, here's Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service.
10 years ago today, tens of thousands of Americans decided to join credit unions. It's now known as Bank Transfer Day. On the first Bank Transfer Day in 2011, it's estimated 40,000 people signed up for credit unions. The transfer happened during the Great Recession, when distrust of big financial institutions that had been bailed out by the federal government was high. Kim Fauché is with Trailhead Credit Union, which at the time had one location and wasn't open on Saturdays.
We opened especially on that day and actually had some conversations with people in the Occupy Portland movement, and so they decided to march to our credit union through downtown, and there was probably about 100 people that marched here with signs and chanting and gathered in our parking lot.
Fauché says other Portland area credit unions had big days as well. She says the movement toward credit unions has continued since then. Her credit union has increased from about 6,000 members to 10,000 over the past decade. Bank Transfer Day was started by a California art gallery owner who said he was fed up with Bank of America's debit card fees. Fauché says credit unions have a different organization when compared with other financial institutions.
Credit unions have a unique not-for-profit cooperative structure, which means credit unions and our members don't pay stockholders. Instead, credit unions return their earnings to members.
Today, there are about 120 million credit union members across the nation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A revolutionary new pill from Pfizer could cut risk of COVID death by 90%, the company says. Pfizer's pill is the first non-injected treatment to be approved for the treatment of COVID. The United Kingdom became the first country to authorize its use yesterday. According to a study of 775 adults with COVID, the pill contributed to an 89% reduction in hospitalizations and deaths. Study participants were unvaccinated, raising the possibility of harm reduction for those who refused to take the vaccine. Nonetheless, health officials continue to stress that the most effective prevention and treatment for COVID-19 remains vaccines. Another pharmaceutical company, Merck, is in the running for developing a COVID antiviral pill. The U.S. federal government is accepting public comments on planned changes to DACA, a program that allows children of undocumented immigrants to remain in the U.S. illegally. New rules are being hailed by immigration activists, but many argue that the only real solution is a clear pathway to citizenship. With more on the story, here's Nadia Ramlagan.
The deadline for public comments on new proposed rule changes to DACA is November 29th, and advocates say it's important for students, employers, and communities affected by the policy designed to protect immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to submit their input. Jasmine Ramirez with the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition explains that among the changes the Biden administration is proposing is the option for individuals to apply either for deferred action or employment authorization separately, which would reduce the cost of the application process.
People can apply for a work permit if they want to, but they don't have to do it.
Comments must be submitted online through the federal portal. The move follows a decision earlier this year by a federal court in Texas that ruled DACA was unlawful. Ramirez explains that while the federal government has appealed the court ruling, it's proposing changes to the program in an attempt to square it with existing legislation. She also emphasizes that while new applications are no longer being accepted, DACA renewals are still being processed. The new rule would clarify that deferred action granted under DACA would make a person, quote, lawfully present, but would not authorize them to stay in the U.S. indefinitely. Ramirez adds that while advocacy groups welcome the proposed changes, she believes they are only a stopgap solution.
The only way that we are going to get a permanent solution without the fear or the constant battling back and forth in the court that the program will end will be through a pathway to citizenship.
Over the past decade, more than 835,000 individuals who arrived in the U.S. as children have been granted DACA status. A 2020 poll found more than 70% of Americans support giving DACA recipients a pathway to citizenship. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Tennessee News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Montana voters turned out this year for pro-conservation candidates. The elections show that environmental stewardship remains a major priority in the state. With more on that story, here's Eric Tegedoff.
Results are in, and conservation is one of the big winners from this week's election in Montana. In municipal races across the state, Montana conservation voters backed candidates one office. In total, 19 of the 21 candidates the group supported came out victorious, including in Bozeman, Livingston, and Whitefish. Denise Joy is among the two candidates backed by the group who won city council races in Billings. Joy says she and many other Montanans were raised to think of themselves as stewards of the land and water.
Across Montana, I'm sure that becomes a very important part of their voting, and an important issue as to where the candidates stand on conservation, access to public lands. All those kinds of things are fundamental to really our lifestyle in Montana.
Joy notes projects are taking place in Billings to aid the environment, such as capturing methane from their landfill and selling it. Conservation-minded candidates won mayoral races in Bozeman, Helena, and Missoula. Stacey Anderson won her race for city council in Missoula, along with 4 other Montana conservation voters-backed candidates for city council. She says conservation is an important part of municipal government.
There's a lot of things that people don't necessarily realize how conservation interacts with the decisions made at the municipal level. We decide land use decisions and open space acquisitions and parks.
Anderson says Missoula is working on a number of issues that intersect with conservation, including updating its growth policy. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
President Biden's new business vaccine mandate is in the process of being finalized, as is his social spending bill. Meanwhile, in Texas, the Department of Justice fights the state over its new voter suppression laws. With those stories and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We know that vaccines absolutely save lives, and we know that mandates work.
Dr. Anthony Fauci defended a new vaccine mandate finalized Thursday. Companies with more than 100 workers must fully vaccinate all employees by January 4th or face penalties. The rule affects 84 million private sector workers. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announced his state is joining Georgia, Alabama, and private plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the mandate.
We're supposed to be a government of laws, not a government of men. This is 500 pages of a government of a bureaucracy, a government that is being run by executive edict, not in accordance with the typical constitutional processes.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats worked to finalize provisions of the budget reconciliation bill Thursday, including tax deductions, immigration policy, and prescription drug pricing.
Our members are engaged in very thoughtful deliberation with each other. 90% of this bill has been agreed to House, Senate, White House, and written.
Senate Judiciary Chair Lindsey Graham slammed the $1.75 trillion social spending bill as misguided.
Should kindergarten be a federal right? Should college be a federal right? No. I want to help people. But the federal government is on a march here to take over everything.
The Justice Department is suing Texas over its new voting law, alleging it is illegal for requiring rejection of mail ballots for immaterial errors and omissions, and disenfranchising voters with limited English proficiency, deployed military members, and voters overseas. The DOJ is also suing Georgia over a similar law. New Jersey Democratic State Senate President Steve Sweeney says he won't concede until the final results of the race for his seat are released. Sweeney was trailing by 2,000 votes when the race was called Thursday for Republican Edward Durr, a truck driver who spent little money on his campaign. Election technology firm Smartmatic is suing Newsmax and One America News Network for defamation, claiming the conservative news outlets spread false pro-Trump conspiracy rumors about the 2020 presidential race. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on Texas's controversial abortion law. Berkeley Law professor Kiara Bridges weighed in on the Supreme Court's use of a shadow docket to expedite its refusal to hear a challenge to the law.
It was extraordinary. It was egregious. It was extreme. Prior to September 1, very few people would have imagined that the Supreme Court would let a flagrantly unconstitutional law go into effect.
This week, the court appeared open to allowing abortion providers to sue. Robert Santos was confirmed by the Senate to head the U.S. Census Bureau and will become the first Latino to lead the agency. Santos is vice president and chief methodologist at the Urban Institute. And finally, the Protect Older Job Applicants Act, passed by the U.S. House, would extend anti-discrimination policies to include job applicants to keep older Americans connected to the workforce. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.
Listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is in the 40s and rainy, and tomorrow brings more of the same. Remember the 5th of November. Tonight, the United Kingdom celebrates Guy Fawkes Night. On this day in 1605, a group of Catholic terrorists failed to blow up the House of Lords and King James I. The holiday's anti-Catholic subtext has made it controversial in modern England, and it is now more oftenly referred to as Bonfire Night. The quote of the day is from Salman Rushdie. How do you defeat terrorism? Don't be terrorized. North Carolina leads the nation in racial disparity in prisons. Advocates from the Sentencing Project are working towards reducing the share of black inmates. Here's Nadia Ramlagan with the Public News Service.
A recent report from the Sentencing Project finds North Carolina to be one of 12 states in which more than half the prison population is black. Criminal justice reform advocates say barriers to reentry often mean people of color end up back behind bars. Managing attorney at Legal Aid, Yolanda Taylor, explains that for the 1 in 4 North Carolinians with criminal records who have served their time, many are unable to financially support themselves and their families.
And we do see how the majority of our clients, if we had to break it down along racial lines, the majority of our clients are African-American people who are who have had past interactions with the judicial system and are now prevented from obtaining a job or from obtaining housing.
Taylor adds that legislation such as the Second Chance Act, signed into law by Governor Roy Cooper last year, will help more individuals get on their feet after incarceration. Beginning December 1st, the law will allow certain misdemeanor and felony charges dismissed in court to be automatically expunged so that individuals will not have to file expungement petitions to remove dismissed charges from their record. Taylor says the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts the poorest black and brown communities.
If people earning less than 150% of the federal poverty level are 15 times more likely to be charged with a felony, which by definition carries a longer sentence, as we know, than those people earning above that threshold.
The report calls on states to eliminate mandatory sentences and stop arrests and prosecutions for low-level drug offenses. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
After a widely publicized and drawn-out campaign, New York cab drivers have finalized a plan with the city to help pay off millions in debt for overvalued taxi medallions. Here's Michaela Savitt with more.
The New York Taxi Workers Alliance and its allies are celebrating a new city deal that will give relief to cab drivers facing debt from purchasing expensive taxi medallions, the permits that allow drivers to own and operate a cab. The agreement adds on to the city's $65 million relief program announced in March. Under the new plan, Outstanding loans will be restructured to hit no more than $200,000, plus with a $30,000 grant from the city. Before the new deal was announced Wednesday afternoon, Victor Salazar with the Alliance noted that the debt crisis has impacted thousands of local cab drivers and hopes it will be a lesson for the future.
I hope that people learn from this crisis that a bunch of immigrants were victims. Immigrants who decided to go for the American dream, to go to middle class and to make a financial commitment to the same city that they serve.
Negotiations wrapped up after more than 6 weeks of round-the-clock rallying by drivers, lawmakers, and groups supporting drivers exploited by predatory lending. The Alliance originally was pushing a plan that would cap all medallion loans to $145,000. The new plan means drivers' monthly loan payments will be capped at around $1,100 a month. Salazar notes that competition with Uber and Lyft has played a role in the debt crisis, along with economic fallout from the pandemic. The win was emotional for the hundreds of members who had been rallying, including Salazar, who has driven a city taxi for 30 years. In a conversation after the deal's announcement, he called the aid a transformation for his industry.
We feel like this has been a historic victory, not only for New York City yellow taxi drivers, but also for the working class.
The union says the average loan balance for medallion debt among New York City cab drivers is $550,000. I'm Michaela Savitt for New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
International leaders are gathered in Glasgow, Scotland this week for the COP26 Climate Conference. The conference has been hailed as the most important climate summit in history, but protesters for climate justice argue that its promises aren't enough. 18-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg spoke to thousands in Glasgow's city center, accusing leaders of using non-binding climate resolutions as a PR tool. She also called out news media for, quote, failing to hold people in power responsible, end quote. Several nations have abstained from the climate talks. China and Russia, the world's first and fourth largest carbon emitters respectively, are staying home and refuse to set deadlines for net zero emissions. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, head of state for the world's third largest emitter, finally agreed to a 2070 net zero deadline, but continues to promote the expansion of coal power. Still, the biggest indicator of emissions is income, not nationality. According to an Oxfam study, the carbon emissions of the world's top 1% wealth bracket will have to decrease nearly 100% in the next decade to avoid catastrophic warming. If met, goals set at COP26 may limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. But as Thunberg and other protesters warn, there is no binding mechanism to keep polluters on track. Satellite photos this week showed a massive buildup of Russian troops on its border with Ukraine. Experts believe the move is intended to pressure Ukraine against building closer ties with NATO and the European Union. Tensions between Russia and the Ukraine have been simmering since the covert Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014 and its de facto occupation of Ukraine's Donbas region. Russian rhetoric in recent weeks has escalated, challenging Ukraine's status as a sovereign country. Key NATO allies may be reluctant to intervene against Russian intervention. Germany and other Central European countries are heavily reliant on Russian natural gas exports, and Russia has dramatically cut fuel access through their European pipelines in the past month. Without adequate green energy infrastructure, the move places much of Europe in an energy crisis. Despite U.S. and Ukrainian protest, Germany is approaching an agreement with the Russian Federation to activate the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline. This pipeline bypasses Poland and Ukraine, potentially undermining their leverage in European affairs. President Biden has warned Chancellor Angela Merkel that connecting to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline would increase Europe's vulnerability to Russian demands. Despite troop accumulation, there is no indication that Russia is preparing for another invasion of Ukraine. A recent UN report showed that national governments aren't doing enough to address the crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women. To indigenous advocates, these findings are no revelation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report from the Government Accountability Office says the federal government is not doing enough to tackle the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie explains.
Advocates have long argued that Indigenous women go missing or are murdered at much higher rates than other demographics. In recent years, Congress passed two laws addressing the issue. But the new GAO report shows that the Justice and Interior Departments are missing important milestones set by the legislation. For example, the agencies failed to create a joint commission to reduce violent crime against Native Americans. And while the Justice Department has begun analyzing data on missing and murdered Indigenous people, it doesn't have a plan yet to continue after this month. Lynette Grable is the director of the nonprofit Not Our Native Daughters. And she's not surprised by the report.
You know, it takes a lot of effort to make things happen and get not only your staff and program and an entire government agency trained on the issue, but also to move forward and implement that.
That said, she also believes the agencies and law enforcement are taking this issue more seriously these days. But it's tough to know where to begin. After the release of the report, members of Congress said the federal government must begin implementing its recommendations. For National Native News, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland hosted the session Elevating Indigenous Youth at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow Friday. Young people from around the world asked questions to panelists in pre-recorded videos. They also voiced concerns about their communities and cultures being at risk due to climate change. Students from Igiagig, Alaska talked about food and other resources.
My name is Seth Hobson Hisalik. I'm in seventh grade in Igiagig School. In our village, we are concerned about climate change we have seen in our area of Alaska. Snow is arriving later and melting earlier. Land is being washed away into the water. The lake is getting smaller each year. Our grandparents used to catch more salmon here, but now the warming oceans are limiting the salmon we catch.
Other students talked about flooding, drought, irregular weather patterns, and environmental justice. Secretary Haaland spoke about work on the federal level to move to a clean energy economy with an emphasis on underrepresented communities. She says it's important to hear from Native youth.
I am incredibly inspired when I have opportunities to meet with young people. So we're going to keep doing that. And that is my commitment to all of you as well. We're going to keep making sure that those young folks have an opportunity to speak with us, because we're going to take a lot of direction from them.
Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Brian Newland co-hosted the panel, which included representatives from world Indigenous organizations. The Bureau of Land Management has finalized the first federal land allotments as part of the Alaska Native Vietnam-era Veteran Land Allotment Program. Through the program, the BLM can provide those eligible to select an allotment of up to 160 acres of federal lands in Alaska or land selected by the state or Native corporations. The program is for Alaska Native Vietnam veterans who did not have access to land allotments while serving in the Vietnam War. The BLM is working with other federal agencies, including the Department of the Interior, to identify veterans and their families. According to the Interior Department, more than 1,400 veterans and families have been contacted, and nearly 130 applications have been received. Land selection is open through December 2025. More information about the program can be found on the BLM's website, blm.gov. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, November 5th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. That's 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, and Michaela Savitt. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the impacts of climate disruption are not theoretical, they are happening. Those already worst off are